Live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB. Brought to you by Mark Keitel with Realty First.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Elise Glink Show, live on Sundays 11 to 1 here on News Talk WSB. Online all the time. Have you checked out my new website, or I should say my new and improved website, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. It's much easier to find things now. I think you'll have a really good experience. But you can also join the ThinkGlink community, sign up for the free weekly newsletter, go to visit me on moneywatch.com. I've been writing this week about a little celebrity stuff and a little foreclosure stuff, all good there, and the Equifax personal finance blog at equifax.com/blog. Lots of good tips this week for people looking for insurance or who still have some remaining tax issues to take care of, equifax.com/blog. So last week we talked about our best money-saving tips, and this week I've been preparing for a speech that I'm going to give tomorrow to a school, a bunch of kids. They're in, I think, 9th or 10th grade, and they are in a really interesting business entrepreneur class. And so the teacher asked me to come in and spend about 45 minutes talking to the kids about real-life money. And you know that I believe that it's the everyday money choices that you make that are going to have a determining factor about whether you have enough money later on in your life. And so it really appeals to me to go in and talk to these kids, because in this everyday money speech that I've been giving all over the country, and last week I was in Stamford, Connecticut, and Rochester, New York, talking to people about this everyday money idea. I talk in there about, in the very end, I go through some last-minute tips and updates, and the number one thing I say is pay yourself first and last. So first is pay into your 401k, last is pay yourself into a Roth IRA, whatever's left. But the number two thing I say is pay your kids second. And so somebody at one of these speeches raised their hands and said, "You mean allowance?" And I kind of laughed because I thought, you know, I have not paid my kids an allowance in years. Years. Now, if you have been a longtime listener to the show, you know that there was a point in time where I did give my kids an allowance and they had to do certain chores and whatever as part of their family contribution. And then somewhere along the way, I noticed my kids weren't spending any money. I know this is a big surprise that I could have kids who wouldn't be like big spenders, but it's true. They just didn't go do the whole shopping thing. Partly it's their boys, and partly, I don't know, the only thing they ever seem to want to buy is candy, and not that much of it. So it's kind of interesting. You know, I'm raising two kids who are not particularly big spenders. And we did all kinds of tricks that I've shared with you over the years. But I thought to myself, you know, what are the ways to bring kids up to make them sensitive to money issues? How do you inspire kids to be savers and not spenders? How do you help them understand what real money is and how very, very difficult it is to earn it? And how do you share with them when something doesn't go well in your financial life? How do you open that door and have a conversation with your kids? And at what age is it appropriate to have that conversation? I meet people all the time who are still afraid to have money conversations with their kids. They're really afraid to have it with their parents. And sometimes they say they want to have it, but they don't know how to open the door, or their parents don't want to have it. And so once in a while, I'll find myself giving advice on how you can open a door and start to have a script running in your head, so that when the moment presents itself, you and your parents can start to have a conversation about money. And so I think, you know, working on it with your kids and making it easier to talk to your kids about money also opens the door, makes it easier to talk to your parents about money. And so I've been thinking about all of this as I've been preparing for this speech tomorrow to these kids. And it's really more of an interactive discussion than a speech, but I'm sort of thinking about what I want to bring forward. And it made me realize that we haven't had this conversation on the show in a very long time. And so I want to open up the phone lines and see how you are bringing money awareness to your kids. And if you've been able to open up and talk to your kids about money and what that conversation looks like. 404-872-0750. Lines are wide open. Would love to have you comment on this. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Also, we'll take other questions as well. But I'm thinking a little bit about money today and how we share with our kids. So I thought I'd kick it off and talk to you a little bit about a couple of the things that I've done over the years to help my kids realize the value of money. And one of the things is when we would go on vacation, we would give our kids a set amount of money. Because what I didn't want to have happen, and I'm sure all of you who have kids know this is true, the minute you go somewhere, it's, oh, Mom, I want that. Mom, I want that. Can I have that? Can I have that? Right? When they're little. And we just kind of nipped that in the bud. I just thought, oh, my gosh, it's my vacation, too. And if I have to fight this fight every single day, I'm going to go out of my mind. So even when they were very, very little, they both understood enough about math to understand the number 20 and how to subtract from it. And so we'd say, okay, we're going to be away a week or two. You can have $20, and you can spend this $20 any way you want, no questions asked. But once the $20 is gone, then you're not going to have anything left, and we're not going to give you any more money. So how was that going to work? So we would walk into a store, or we were in the airport, and we'd go into the little shop, and I'd say, okay, let's take a, what would you want to buy in this store? And Michael, of course, would go, I want that. He'd point to some candy. He likes that sweet, sour, kind of acidy kind of candy. Very bad for the teeth, I might mention. So I'd say, okay, that's $1.50 for that thing. And how much is 20 minus $1.50? And he'd say, $18.50. And I'd say, okay, if you buy this, now you only have $18.50 left. So when he was really little, that seemed like a lot of money. And when he got a little bit older, he realized how quickly that would add up. What else do you want? What else do you want? So before we even went shopping, we were pre-shopping. We were talking about how the number would subtract, and he'd get all the way down. You know, then he saw this book he really wanted. We were in Arizona. Actually, this was a funny little aside. This trip we went to Arizona, the kids were really little, maybe 5 and 7. And we're in the parking lot of this hotel, and all of a sudden I say to Sam, I said, stop the car. We'd almost run over Clark Howard in the parking lot. True story. And I pop out of the car, and I'm like, Clark, what are you doing here? And he said, Elise, what are you doing here? Because we're almost never in the same place at the same time, because I'm always filling in for him while he's on vacation. And we just happened to be in Arizona at the exact same moment. And what do you think his first question was? Total aside here. He said, how much are you paying for your room? Clark lives it every single day. Anyway, back to my story, which was, so Michael was in the gift shop at the hotel, and he saw this book called Amazing Arizona. And it was puzzles, like mazes, for very famous areas in Arizona, you know, the desert, and the puzzle would. And he's always been a puzzle kid and a maze kid, and he really wanted this book. But the book was $8 and, like, say, 52 cents with tax. And he realized that it would subtract too much from his 20s. So, you know, from his $20 bill. So every store we went to, he would find that book. He saw it about 4 or 5 different times, and he would always pick it up, and he would always look at it. And it was clear to me he really desperately wanted it. And one of the rules in our family is that if you want a book, you can always have a book. But I wanted him to understand the $20 difference. And so he kept waiting, and he kept waiting and kept waiting. And finally, we're in the airport going home, and he really hadn't spent his money. And I said, Michael, you can spend the money now. You've got the 20, you know, you've still got your $20. Maybe by then it was $17 or something. You've got plenty of money to buy this book. He says, no, Mom, I know when I get home, I'll still have the $17. But if I buy the book and I do the puzzles, then it'll all be used up. So I thought that was an amazing lesson. And because he'd realized that, we bought him the book anyway to play on the way home. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. How do you talk to your kids about money? What do you tell them? What did your parents tell you? You know, we had Mother's Day recently. Now we're going into Father's Day. You know, what are some of the gifts that money gifts that your parents have given you. And how do you share that? How do you turn around and share that? And do you reach out to your nieces and nephews if you feel like your siblings aren't doing a very good job? Or do you reach up to grandparents and help them if they still don't understand basic money lessons? I mean, one of the tragedies in this country is that there are a lot of little old ladies out there, and unfortunately it is the little old ladies who have outlived their husbands but never managed money on their own, and they are widowed, and then they find that here they are in their 70s and their 80s, and now they're having to learn about money in a way they never had to learn about it before. And how do you start to think about those lessons? And maybe you're a sandwich generation, and you're having to help your kids while you're helping your parents. I think there's a lot of lessons to go around. All right, so I'm going to open up the phone lines, 404-872-0750. Kids and money, how do you share it? Give us a call, 16 minutes past the hour. Brian joins us on the line from Marietta. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hi.
What I've done with my youngest, who's a second grader, recently we were out working in the yard, and I told him, I'll give you a dollar for every bucket of sticks and pine cones and stuff you pick up. It was a good-sized bucket. He was out there for probably 4 hours, and he made $6.
Wow.
The next day, we're at his sister's soccer game, and he wanted something. I said, well, how much is this? $2. Well, that's two buckets of sticks. I mean, it would put it in more perspective for him.
Right.
And he decided against he didn't need that candy. So I think it was learning the value of a dollar as opposed to it's just a dollar. But, you know, what does it take to get that dollar was really helpful for him. I have to say, with my older kids, who are a senior in high school and college, I probably haven't done as good a job, so I'm trying much harder with them.
You know, it's amazing when you put things, that's actually brilliant, and I've done that for my kids as well. When you put it in a perspective like that for them, and they really understand the hard work involved, that's genius.
Good.
That's genius. I love that. So what are you doing for your older kids who are now in college?
One's in college, one's a senior in high school. One's had the Hope Scholarship for 4 years, so.
Right.
But the struggle I have, I look at what it takes to get a job when you get out of school, and what do you want to take. I have a technical background, and it's pretty easy for me to find a job. But everything you read about nowadays is kids want to go to school and, you know, they want to take what they want to take. It looks like fun, but it isn't necessarily going to get them anywhere in life. And that's a struggle to educate them on. You know, looking for a college education is an investment in their earning power in the future, as opposed to just 4 years of fun.
It is very interesting. It's a different way of thinking about how you're going to gear yourself up. I sometimes feel like, and I know I've read some research on it, that because we're now living so long, you know, you're going to live to be 80, 90, that this adolescence period that would have normally ended at 18 when you went to college now is kind of stretching into the mid-20s.
Yeah.
And people aren't really thinking about adulthood until they get into their 30s and 40s, which is good for me in my mid-40s. But it's kind of a shift in the way that things are working. And it does require a little bit of a different approach as a parent. It sounds like you're trying to work through that with them.
Well, and I think the lesson I tell everybody is you got to live on less than you make. No matter if you make $1 million a year, if you make $30,000 a year, you've got to live on less than you make. And
yeah.
You know, that's a tough call when you're making at the low end of the scale, but that's the reality for life, so you've got to kind of plan that way. But anyway, thanks.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you for sharing. Those are absolutely great lessons. How do you teach your kids to save money? 404-872-0750. I think that there are some wonderful ways to do it, and we've got a whole lot of callers lined up. We're going to get to you guys just in a moment. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to AM 750, now 95.5 FM, News Talk, WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
It'd be a paradise, put up a fucking line. This is the day of the expanding man. That shape is
26 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. We are talking about teaching your kids about the value of a buck. So hard to earn these days and really hard to pass down that lesson, as it turns out. 404-872-0750. I'm looking for your best ideas on how to teach your kids how to save money. Loretta joins us on the line. Loretta, what's your best idea?
My best idea is just to be really, really honest with my son. I show him the checkbook and how we balance money, but I also try to keep things on his level. He really enjoys video games. And I can remember once he went to a video game retailer where he could resell them for a new game or trade for another one. And he learned the value of depreciation.
Ah.
He had games that were $60 new. And when he went to trade them, he only got about $5 or $10. And he was absolutely floored to the point of tears.
Oh.
And that was, I mean, it was a lesson on his level, and he understands now. And I try to do that in every situation that he puts himself in, whether it's something, some money that he's saving for, you know, a game or something, you know, money that his grandparents may have given him.
Mm-hmm.
Just in your face, like, this is how life really works. And I think keeping it, you know, very real with him, he understands it a lot better.
How old was he when you started that?
He was probably about 11.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And now he's 14 years old, and he really understands now.
So do you take him to buy used games instead of new games? Because that's what my son Michael likes to do.
Absolutely. I teach him, you know, I say, hey, remember when we went to this place and they only gave you $10 for this game that was $60?
Yeah. You know, it's really a nice way to sort of make it in relief, kind of the way that Brian did for his kid with the bucket of sticks, where, you know, yeah, you collected, you spent 4 hours and got $6 of sticks, and now you want something for $2. That's two buckets. What are you going to do? It's a great way to do it. Loretta, thanks so much. What's your best idea for teaching kids about the value of a dollar? 404-872-0750. Call and share now on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
36 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show. Welcome back, everybody. Show notes a little bit later on today at thinklink.com. I'm going to put up everyone's suggestions about how to teach your kids about money. That's kind of what we're talking about today. How do you pass down the values, the money values that your parents gave you, or if they didn't give you any money values, the ones you've accumulated all on your very own? How do you pass those down and grow a next generation of money-savvy kids? Because I got to tell you, with what's happening in Medicare and Social Security and the way we're going in this country, I think we're going to all need every single dollar. So what's your best money-saving tip, and how have you taught your kids to save money? 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I want to hear about all of your great ideas. Jeff joins us on the line from McDonough. Jeff, how have you helped teach your kids about money?
Well, actually, I can tell you how I was taught. I was taught by parents that were very frugal, and they basically counted every penny, and I followed that principle. I was raised that way, and it worked for me and my kids, too. But I have a different problem.
Okay.
My problem is, this, I guess what's called the sandwich generation problem.
Mm-hmm.
I have two siblings, and my parents are 81. And my father accumulated a great deal of stock in a company he worked for, and it's worth several million dollars. And,
wow.
And he's in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, and my mother has never really taken care of any of the money. It's always been him. That's why we learned our frugality, because he's a very very frugal guy,
uh-huh.
and he's a great guy, but he watches everything, or at least he did. Now she's handling the money, and my concern is, while she feels that she can handle things, we're a little concerned that she can't. About a year and a half ago, and I didn't find this out until recently, they went into the bank to roll over a CD. It was $80,000, and somebody there was sitting at a desk, and they thought a bank employee sold them an annuity that was fine. Well, it wasn't fine. It's just what happened. But the grandchildren are the beneficiaries, and the long and short of it is, you know, my mother heard the individual telling my father that it was, well, my words, she just heard CD, and I'm sure he said like a CD or some words like that. So that he, my father signed and invested the $80,000 in that annuity, and now the grandkids are the beneficiaries. And you know, I was willing to go to the company and complain, the insurance company, and that they took advantage of him. And she said, no, that's fine, the kids will get it, and you know, so on. Well, that's only part of my point. My real point is that we've talked about this, and even though I actually have power of attorney and so on, I feel that I would like somebody, some independent person, they're about 300 miles away,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, look over the checkbook, manage them, not manage investments. Their investments are fine. Most of
you just need somebody to help your mother make sure she's not being taken advantage of, guide some decisions as your father gets to this later stage.
Yes.
That's really what you need.
And some independent person. So my two sisters don't believe that I'm exerting any influence over her to do this, that, or the other, because there is a large amount of money involved. We're talking, mm-hmm. A few million dollars. And the money is invested, and it's spinning off dividends, and they're doing just fine. But there's a day that will come, and those dividends, in terms of how it's being handled, is always a question. And, yeah, that's what I'm looking for, someone that would...
It sounds to me like what your mother needs is a bookkeeper, somebody who is going to help her. And I would suggest that whoever does their taxes, or maybe somebody who does your taxes, can help you find somebody locally for them who can come in, put their money onto, let's say, Quicken, or onto a program that's online so that you can see it as well.
Well, I have a bigger question. And actually, I do their taxes, but which is probably part of the problem, but I do. Is there a profession? I mean, I know what CPAs are. I'm married to one. I know what financial advisors are. Is there a profession that does this, that would be bonded and insured or whatever, that would give us reports? And
yes, they're called money managers, but not the kind of money managers that you're, not like investment return money managers. But think about celebrities. They hire people to manage the money, pay the bills, do all that stuff. That's the kind of person you're really looking for. But I think you can get a bookkeeper who works for, let's say, you know, one of my business partners has an accountant who has her own practice. She comes in and she handles the money for the business. She pays the bills. She makes sure that everything gets tied out. The expense reports are filed. Somebody like that can do that for your mother. And once a week she comes in, or he comes in, and they balance the books and make sure the money is there, and that it's, you know, still nothing's really changed. And they're the person who, you know, it would have to go through you. You would get reports and you would be in touch. But they would help your mother manage the day-to-day aspect of her money. So she wouldn't have to worry about that. And I think that that is probably going to be, unless you live in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, going to be the place to start, because you don't really need a celebrity money manager. You need somebody who is like this bookkeeper person who comes in and helps your mom with all of these, the bookkeeping duties. And this is something that I think getting it onto a system like Quicken, since you do the taxes, maybe you do it with TurboTax, you can probably get it onto Quicken Online, and then everything will feed in. All of the different accounts, all of the different, you know, stock accounts, whatever it is, feeds into the system so that you can see it from wherever you are at any point in time. And that's really what you want to do here, is leverage technology and leverage somebody on the ground who can help do this sort of day-to-day managing and make sure your mom has enough cash in her wallet and whatever, but is also managing the checkbook so that she's not writing big checks to people who claim they want to come and repair the roof, for example, and get scammed like that, and that she's really managing it, and that the money that's in the stocks doesn't get disappear, and you're watching it from afar. I mean, you might even be able to manage it out of a Fidelity account or something. so that you actually have that control over it. And I think that's probably going to solve a whole lot of your problems. 404-872-0750. We're talking about ways to teach your kids about money. And, of course, if you're a sandwich generation, how you're helping your kids and your parents with their money. Sandy joins us on the line from Lawrenceville. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. What's your best tip for helping your kids learn about money?
Well, I have two boys just like you, although mine are a little bit older. But when my boys were preschoolers, one was probably just an infant. My son, as we would go to department stores on the way out, he'd always see those little gumball machines.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how kids always want something at the register
always, all
the time. Well, probably 2 or 3 weeks, I'd go buy it and say, no, that's going to go ahead and take your money, waste your money, you know, you lose your money because penny saved is a penny earned. And anyway, I did that for about 3 weeks, and he just was insistent, I want that, I want that, I want that. It was a Ghostbuster tattoo or something, whatever it was. Anyway, about the third weekend, I said, okay, he's watching all the other little kids do that, and I said, do you really want this? He says, yes, yes. And I said, well, here's your quarter. Now tell me which one you want. And he pointed at the one that he wanted. I said, well, what about this one over here? It's really cute. No, no, no. I want that one right here, right here. Well, I took my odds, which were pretty astronomical at the time, and I gave him the quarter, and I had him put it in, and he got it out, and his eyes just looked at me in an appalling manner like, what is this? And I said, see what I told you? All of those machines do is take your money. You don't have any guarantee of what you have. And so it's like almost like a gambling tip and a behavior modification all at the same time. And I'm really proud because, you know, just those little tips like that made a difference. And, gosh, at 27 years old, that boy probably has more money than my husband and I did combined over the course of years just on those little tips. But that's kind of what you have to do. You have to start little. You have to start young. And you have to make a point of making sure they understand that saving your money and putting it in the best choices are the ones, you know, the way to go about doing it.
Oh, I love that tip. And I bet he never asked for that again.
Absolutely not. And then I, on the flip side, just so that you can think about that too, my youngest son just got married 3 months ago.
Congratulations.
And of course, thank you. And of course, I got the mail, so, you know, you don't want to get too butting in on what to say to them or giving them all this extra advice because that's mom's job, you know, in the family.
Yeah.
So one of the things that every time I want to give him a piece of advice, I keep this one idea in my mind. I tell him, with two incomes, live on the first one, plan on the second.
Oh, it's so great. Live on the first, bank the second, or plan yours, plan on the second. Love that. Those are great tips. Thanks so much for sharing, Sandy. 47 minutes past the hour. Kathy joins us on the line. Kathy, what are your money-saving tips for kids?
Hi, thank you. My daughter's grown up now, but when she was younger and I wasn't making a lot of money, not that I'm making that much now, but she'd want to go out to eat. She had a favorite sit-down restaurant, and you know, versus fast food restaurant, and she'd ask if we could go eat there, and I'd figure out how much it was going to cost because I knew what she liked to order there, and I'd tell her, okay, Mama's going to have to work 3 or 4 hours in order to pay for this meal. Do you still want to go? It's okay. We can do it this time. But do you still want to go? I'm going to have to work 3 or 4 hours to pay for this. And she thought about it for a minute. She said, no, Mama, I don't want you to have to do that.
Oh.
And
sweet.
That example came into play a lot. And she's 19 now, and when she can, she offers to pay.
Oh. That's nice.
So
she really, she was so worried about you and thinking about you.
About having to work that many hours to just pay for that one meal. So, you know, I think that time she suggested, how about a Happy Meal? And she did the math and she figured up. She said, you'd only have to work an hour to pay for 2 Happy Meals for us.
Nice. I just love that lesson just all the way down the line. I mean, there's so many lovely messages there, and she sounds like, you know, such a terrific kid. I just think that's wonderful. Congratulations. 404-872-0750. What is your best money-saving tip for kids? Sue Ellen joins us on the line from Atlanta. What's yours, Sue Ellen?
Well, thank you for taking my call, first of all, and I really like listening to you on Sunday mornings.
Thank you.
My father, pretty much, he was a single dad, and he raised my sister, brother, and I with a debt-free mentality. We just saw him spend, it was cash. It was a cash-only lifestyle, and I'm sure he had checks down there somewhere, but he just always said, if you don't have the cash, you can't buy it. And he didn't really have credit cards, things like that. And we grew up in a very small town in Alabama, so, you know, we didn't really have the temptations that kids have, I guess, in the city. And so I've just had my first child, and I'm, you know, in my 40s, and I've managed to live a debt-free life. And I'm really hoping that I can share with my child the same lessons, because being debt-free has allowed me to do so many things and to have just a free spirit of mine that so many of my peers don't. And I just can't stress that enough.
That's really a wonderful gift. If you can give the gift of being debt-free to your kids, that is really amazing. Sue Ellen, thanks so much for your call. What is your best money-saving tip? Give us a call, 404-872-0750. We've got news, weather, and traffic coming up at the top of the hour. This week in your Sunday Atlanta Journal-Constitution, there's a special report that examines how the one-cent sale tax vote could mean billions of dollars in transportation changes. 10 before the hour, AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey. And midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750. And now, 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
55 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. We are talking about kids and money this hour. How is it that you can pass down those money lessons about how hard it is to earn all that money, and how you have to be savvy and sophisticated about spending in today's economy? 404-872-0750 is our number here at the station. Richard joins us in Suwannee. So, Richard, what's your best money-saving tip for kids?
Yeah, hi. I enjoy your show a lot.
Thanks.
I guess I'm just going to tell you the results of an experiment, if that makes any sense.
All right.
We've got three little kids, 5, 7, and 9, and we thought, gee, we want to teach them about money by giving them an allowance, you know, exchange for chores around the house and so on. Mm-hmm. And so we would keep a chart of, you know, when they would do this chore, they would get this much money. But they never made, at least for a while, they didn't make the connection between the amount of money written on the refrigerator and value that they actually had. We would occasionally take them to the store and they could spend that money, but they just didn't get it. When we started, we just recently started putting their money in a jar. So each kid has their own little glass jar. And every time they do something, we immediately give them the money that they put in the jar. And suddenly they get it. And then they take their money with them to go spend it. And now they understand how, they really understand the value of a dollar. Our next experiment is going to teach them this. We're going to try to teach them to save by giving them a little bit of interest each month. If they keep it through a month, then we'll see how that goes.
Let me give you something that we've done very successfully with our kids. So I love the change jar. I've been saving change forever, and I have a big change jar. And when I save change, I told everybody recently that I probably save $300-$500 a year in it. But with our kids, what we did is when they were about 7 and 9, we opened up an account. They had these little saver accounts in our local bank. And every time they put money in, we would double it.
Oh, okay.
So they could instantly see the value of doubling and what that would do for them. But if they ever wanted to take money, we also took out our share.
Oh, okay.
So if they put in $20 that they'd saved in their jar, we would match that and put in another $20. But if they wanted to take out that $20 to go buy something, our $20 came out too. It only was good on certain expenses like college tuition way down the line. So we really wanted to teach them short-term, long-term savings and what that meant. And I got to tell you, our kids have never taken money out of those accounts. The idea that they would lose that $20 was a little too painful. I'm Elise Glink. We've got all kinds of stuff coming up next. Stay tuned, and a prize pack to give away. Your questions as well, 404-872-0750 on News Talk WSB.
It's live. Expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB. Brought to you by Mark Tytel with Realty First.
6 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks so much for joining me this morning. Our number 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time. ThinkGlink.com, ThinkGlink.com. So glad you could join us today. Coming up at the end of this hour, Mike Tytel will be back in the studio talking about short sales, what's going on. We're going to take that coming up. We had a really interesting week in the stock market this week, in the news. It was sort of hard to even imagine, but we saw the head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, get arrested, pulled out of his first-class Air France seat because a chambermaid or maid at this fancy hotel that he was staying at in New York accused him of trying to rape her, and they pulled him off, and he's now in home confinement, and this has caused quite the stir internationally. And, of course, with the International Monetary Fund of all. So that was quite an interesting thing this week. The Dow went down on Friday 93 points, down to about 12,500. It's kind of a new trading range, sort of interesting. We've seen the bond market sort of change a little bit. And, there was President Obama offered a very interesting two-state solution. Went back to the pre-1967 borders. It's kind of a busy week, and all of it had an impact on the stock market. We saw the stock market go up and down. We've seen Japan fall into quite a serious recession. It's the second quarter. Their economy contracted by about 3.5%, and that was far more than economists had anticipated. One other thing that's sort of interesting about Japan is how their recession is starting to affect us. So my neighbor is going to sell his black Honda Odyssey. The two of us bought the same Honda Odyssey about 8 years ago. They're both 8 years old, and he's decided he wants to get a new car. That one he thinks is going to need a transmission soon, and he doesn't feel like paying $4,000 for it. Excuse me. And so he went over to CarMax, and he was absolutely shocked to find out that he could get $8,000 and change for an 8-year-old Honda Odyssey. He only paid, we both did the same thing, I think we got a slightly better deal, but about, let's see, $26,000. And so this means that after 8 years, that car still is retaining a third of its value. That's somewhat amazing. And what the real reason that that's happening, and the LA Times like hit the nail on the head this morning, it's that basically inventory shortages are being caused by the effects of Japan's earthquakes that have led to rising prices for new and used cars, creating, they said, what one analyst described as a huge seller's market. Huge seller's market. And I think that's really true. I mean, if you have to buy a car right now, it's pretty expensive, and that's because you're seeing the inventory drop dramatically. So there was another story, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, maybe the New York Times last week, where they looked at three or four popular Japanese car dealerships around the East Coast, the kind of dealerships that sell 50 cars a month of a certain type of car, and they were only expected to get one or two in. So it's a tremendous shortage all over the place. And, car dealers are happy because they mean that this means they don't really have to do deals. But if you're selling a car right now, this is a great thing because they used car lots simply don't have enough inventory. And so people are thinking about postponing a purchase because the consumers lost all leverage whatsoever. So how does this, and why is this like this? Well, Toyota Motor Corp, Toyota's U.S. factories, so this is U.S. factories, are operating at just 30% capacity this month because Japan-related parts shortages. So whatever companies in Japan were manufacturing parts that are needed by the factory here, they can't get them. so they're at 30%. Honda is warning that its supply of vehicles is diminished and basically trying to find a Camry, Corolla, or that's a Toyota car, or a Honda Civic or CR-V SUV, really difficult to find those. Between them, Toyota and Honda, with Lexus and Acura, are a quarter of all U.S. auto sales and an even larger share of the retail market. So you're talking about an industry that's been really hard hit, but is going to continue to be hard hit because while automakers are working hard to catch up during the second half of the year, analysts say that about 700,000 vehicles will simply never be built because of the earthquake. Never be built. That's a huge number of cars. So on the on this side of the fence, General Motors and Ford are raising sticker prices, right? And they're cutting out the cash back offers. They're raising auto loan interest rates. And consumers simply, in my mind, do not have the firepower to pay all those increased prices. So dealers are going to charge a few hundred dollars more. Manufacturers are going to cut back incentives by $1,000 or $1,500. People are going to stop buying cars again. They're absolutely going to stop buying cars. So very interesting what's happened with new cars. And, you know, eventually people are going to actually are going to have to buy those new cars. But kind of interesting to see what's happening. And so when you take a look at, like, the Japanese recession and you think, you know, contracting by 3.25%, that's pretty significant. What else happened this week? Well, Greece went back to the till and basically said, we can't afford what we have. Greece wants to restructure its debt, and the European officials are suggesting that maturities or basically the length of the term of the Greek bonds be expanded. Greece had 110 billion euro, which is like $140-160 million, billion dollars bailout package. But conditions are getting worse in Greece, and Fitch has sharply downgraded Greece's debt this week, so that wasn't so good. On the other side, LinkedIn, for all of those of you who are on LinkedIn like I am, LinkedIn absolutely had an unbelievable day of trading, doubling in its first day of trading. It closed at about 92. It's worth almost $9 billion. Some people are looking for that to contract a bit. And Dell had a very good first quarter, surging 177%. So it's kind of an interesting mixed bag, and it's going to be hard to see sort of where we are right now. It's some things are getting better. We are creating more jobs, but people are still getting laid off at a ridiculous rate. And so we need to, and people are still leaving the job market, which is terrible altogether. So we're really in a kind of a mixed bag economically. It'll be interesting to see what's going to happen going forward. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. How can we help you today? Money, real estate, credit, debt. Brett joins us on the line. Hey, Brett, welcome to the Elise Klink Show.
Hi, how are you doing?
You know, I'm doing great. How's your Sunday going?
Really nice. Just driving around looking at houses.
Good. What are you finding?
Well, my question for you is about a house that we found, and the reason that it drew that we were drawn to it from our attention was that it's priced really low because it's a short sale. And the house is perfect. The neighborhood's perfect. We would love it. But then we found out that the owner, the seller, is not behind on any of his payments. And he owes quite a bit more than what it's listed for, but even what, you know, it would be worth right now. And so the seller wants us to pretty much contract away us even looking for another house while we go through the short sale process. And I don't really want to do that if I don't think that the bank's going to approve the short sale. And so my question, I guess, is what are the chances of the bank approving a short sale, A, when he's not behind on payments, and, two, when there's quite a significant difference between the loan amount and what the short sale amount would be?
Well, I think the bank might approve it, but he won't know because he hasn't actually talked to the bank about it yet. And the question you have to ask is, does the seller actually not have any cash to make up the difference? Because if the seller, set aside the issue of being late on a payment, because you don't really necessarily have to be late on a payment to do a short sale. But if you think about whether the seller has a pot of cash and they're going to make up the difference, or if they know that they're going to be required to make up the difference, or they have had a conversation with the lender or they haven't, where they say, you know, this is what the house is worth, this is what we're going to list it for, is this price okay with you? If they haven't actually even started that, then there's no way you want to make an exclusive offer. What you want to do is make an offer, but give them a time frame in which you can back out.
Right.
So do you know if they have any cash that they're going to make up the difference?
In our talking with them, that has not been a part of it. So it would be my guess that that's not the case.
Okay.
But that's good. I mean, I haven't asked. I haven't thought about that. I thought that in short sales, the bank just approved that. I didn't know that it was possible for the seller to make up the payments.
It is possible.
Or make up the difference.
You know, you're actually kind of required to do that. I mean, unless the bank has agreed to take less, you're required to do that. So I guess what I would say to this seller is that, you know, we'd love to work with you, but you really need to get a price from your bank that they're willing to take. And you can go there and you can request it, and then, you know, this is the offer we're willing to make, and if we can get the bank to look at it, great. Banks are getting, they are approving short sales more quickly. Some banks, we heard from Mark Titel, who's the GetOutStartOver.com guy who comes on the show every week, and we heard from him that actually Bank of America, I don't know if their loan is with Bank of America, but Bank of America has gotten much faster in responding to short sales. So instead of it taking 6 months, maybe it takes 3 months.
Okay.
But it's still not going to be immediate. So I think you have to be savvy. Are you working with a broker as well?
Yes.
Okay. So what does your broker say?
Well, it's interesting because the seller's agent is saying, oh, we do this all the time for doctors and lawyers who want to protect their credit, and they're not behind, and we do this. And then my agent is saying, we've never really seen it work out very successfully. And so, I mean, both agents are speaking to their clients' interests, so I'm just trying to get kind of an impartial view of whether or not this happens with any regularity.
I would say that it's a wild, wild west approach, right? But it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's not to say it doesn't happen, but it would be better for them to have talked to the bank by now. Because if it is truly a short sale and the sellers have no money and aren't going to be able to make up the difference, it's going to be up to the bank whether or not they want to take this.
Okay. The seller did actually meet with the bank on Wednesday, and he should be getting a BPO within the next 10 days, I guess, is how it works. So I guess we'll probably wait to hear back from that. But our guess is that the market value from looking at comparable homes in the neighborhood is still about 20 to 30,000 higher than what, you know, they were what they had listed it at and what we were interested in paying. And so that's kind of a lot of money that I don't know that the bank would have much motivation to eat, you know, if he's still current on his payments, he's got a job, you know.
You know, I think you have to separate yourself from that. You're worrying about things you can't control. All you can control is you making an offer for this house. And what's going to... Do you need a mortgage to buy this house?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Do you need a mortgage?
Yes.
So since you need a mortgage to buy this house, you can't overpay for the house.
Right.
Because you'll never be able to get the right mortgage. So your hands are going to be tied to the true value of this property, and so is the seller, and so is the lender. And then the lender is just going to have to decide if they feel like taking a bath now, or they're going to make this guy pay the mortgage for a little while longer, postponing the inevitable. And you can't control that. So I would not sign anything that precludes you from looking for another house.
Right.
I would say that you're going to sign this, but at any point in time, you have the right to withdraw your offer if they haven't approved it. And
okay.
That's just how you're going to do it. And you need to stay in control of the process.
Yeah.
All right?
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks.
You're welcome, Brett. Keep looking. Keep driving around. Be safe while you drive and let me know what happens. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Blank. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Six minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to the Elise Glink Show. Let's go back to the phone. Stephen joins us on the line from Lawrenceville. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, how's it going?
Things are good. Happy Sunday.
Yeah, to you as well. I guess I have some general financial questions that I wanted to ask you to give you a little background. I think I'm in a fortunate situation. Just got out of college and I started my first job, my first non-student job.
Great.
And I actually got married on Thursday as well.
So, Thursday. Congratulations.
Thank you. Things are going very well. And I guess my wife and I are kind of curious about what steps you think we should take being in a new situation now where we're, you know, our income level is a lot different than it was when we were just students. So, in, you know, given the present economic situation, what do you have, sort of, what kind of advice do you have for newlyweds who are coming upon, I guess, significant income?
Well, the first thing is you want to pay down debt.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, you have any debt?
We have a little student debt. I got through college without it, but she has debt.
Get rid of the debt. You should spend, and I'll take this from a budget that we've been working with. It's called the 50-30-20 budget. 50% are for your cannot live without expenses. So that would be, I would say, you know, rent or a mortgage, food on the table, not restaurants out. Basic kind of transportation, how to get to your job, insurance, you know, basic expenses that you cannot live without. And then 20% is savings and debt. This is your take-home pay dollars. And then the rest, either save some more of it or use it for a few extra perk things.
Okay, and so, I guess as far as savings go, what options would you recommend?
Well, since you're in a job, what I would recommend is that you both open up a Roth IRA. You're entitled to one because you have earned income, and she's entitled to one as your spouse if she does not have earned income or earned income on her own. You're both young, but you can put away $5,000 each, so $10,000 total per year after tax, invested any way you want. So open it up at Vanguard, pick out three inexpensive index mutual funds, salt the money away in there, and you are going to have plenty of options down the line the rest of your life. 404-872-0750. I have loads of other money saving and money investing suggestions on my website, thinkglink.com. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Six minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks for listening this Sunday, 404-872-0750. Don't forget to check me out online, thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Show notes will be up about an hour or so, hopefully. If all things go well, of course, it's a beautiful day, so maybe not up an hour after the show. But I'm going to do my very best. And don't forget to check out moneywatch.com, where I've been blogging about the latest in celebrity doodads. In fact, there was a piece that ran this weekend that I wrote about Maria Shriver and Arnold Schwarzenegger's former home that just went on the market, and it's for sale. So you may want to check that out as well. And also, the realtors have been playing fast with the numbers. I've got a story up about how just changing the way the numbers are calculated erased 600 listing days from the average time in one city. The average number of days in the market was 700-plus days. And with a little flick of the switch and a little revision of the numbers, whoa, magically, it's only about 100 days on the market. So big changes afoot and what that means for you, all at moneywatch.com. 404-872-0750. Let's go back to the phones. Ron joins us on the line. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Yes, how you doing this evening?
Good.
Good afternoon. I want to ask you a question about going from a
going from employment to self-employment,
okay.
being able to qualify for a home mortgage.
Well, unfortunately, if you are self-employed, you're going to have to be self-employed for at least 2 years.
That's the problem I'm having.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to qualify pretty much sooner than that. They're going to want to see 2 years worth of tax returns plus a current profit and loss.
So you don't have any other suggestions of...
You can look around and see if there's a local lender, but how long have you been self-employed?
Probably about 6 months now.
And are you showing real income from that?
Oh, yes, ma'am. And I'm still in the same line of work also.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a pretty high credit score, so just the employment has changed.
Yeah, I think you're going to have a hard time. I mean, it's always worthwhile getting a copy of your credit history and credit score and going to visit some local lenders. Fannie and Freddie Mae won't approve your loan, so you're not going to get any of the national lenders unless they've got portfolio loans that they're doing.
Exactly.
And it's not worth buying a house if you have to pay 13% interest, right? So
you're just
much better off renting. So unfortunately, I would say to you that at 6 months, it's going to be almost, I would say, extremely difficult. Plus, you're going to have to put more as a down payment. You're not going to be able to get 5 or 10% down. They may want to see 30% down.
Oh,
so I think you're gonna have to plan for this going forward, and it's unfortunately not gonna allow you to take advantage of where we are right now. But I don't see interest rates going up dramatically, you know, in the next 4 or 5 months. So you may have a chance once you've been self-employed a year and you can show it on your tax return. That's really what they're gonna want to see. 404-872-0750. Brian joins us on the line from Decatur. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Elise. How's it going?
Great. What's on your mind?
I am a current medical student. I'm living entirely off of loans. And given the current foreclosure market, I was actually thinking about buying a place. And I wanted to know what your thoughts were on buying a place funded entirely off of loans.
Well, you're not going to qualify.
Actually, I've already pre-qualified because my dad has co-signed with me.
Ah, okay. So you've qualified with your dad's help.
That's right.
And what do I think about using your money, your loan money? Well, you're going to use some of that loan money for housing anyway.
That's right. So my goal is to actually get the payment about the same as what I would be paying for rent anyways.
Okay. So remember that when you pay for rent, it usually includes heat, although not usually electricity.
Right.
And when you buy a house, you've got mortgage, you've got taxes, you've got insurance, you've got maintenance and upkeep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's typically more that's rolled into your loan. So just don't overextend yourself.
I see.
But as a medical student, you know, if you feel like you're going to be earning enough and you're going to be living in the same place, that's fine. But what happens, like, if you go on, I mean, after you graduate from medical school, don't you apply for residency somewhere?
That is true. My goal is, though, I move back to Atlanta to be near my family and to stay here during internship and residency. So I'm looking, that's part of the reason why I was looking to buy, was because I'm looking at this as a long-term thing anyways, being in Atlanta.
What happens if you don't get a residency here?
If I don't get a residency, well, then I would have to move. But right now, like, I've actually been pre-approved, and I'm actually already have a realtor, and I have a place that I'm actually already looking at. It's about $50,000.
Oh, okay.
But my parents are pretty well off, and I think that if I did have to move, renting it wouldn't be a problem.
Well, at 50, okay, let me just, you've sold me on $50,000.
Okay.
Because on $50,000, to rent that out and have you break even is not that much. Is it a one-bedroom apartment?
It's a two-bedroom condo.
You're done. Because at two bedrooms, you could probably rent it out for $400 a month per room.
Mm-hmm.
And more than break even.
Okay.
So I'm good with that.
Now, the catch is the HOA fees. Now, the HOA on this place is $400.
Mm-hmm.
And so the HOAs are kind of the kicker for a lot of these places. Like, sometimes the HOAs are a little bit high. And do you think $400 is okay? Because it looks like with
how
the
many? Okay, wait a second. Brian, the question that you should be asking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna humbly suggest you buy a copy of my book, both of my books, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask, and also the new one, Buy, Close, Move In.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get them online. They're paperback for not very much money, just a few bucks. But,
yes.
You know, the problem that you're facing with condos these days is that if a lot of people have gone into foreclosure in the condo and are not paying their HOA fees, the rest of the community has to make up that difference.
I see.
Because, and that's a risk, right? So do you know how many people are behind in their payments in the property?
I can look into it. It's an older property from the, I think it was built in the 70s, so the occupancy is really high.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of foreclosures coming through. But I think it's like it's a 1,000-unit community. It's a very big one. So, but I guess to answer your question, I don't actually know the answer to that.
You should find that out. You should also find out if you can rent it. Because a lot of these communities don't allow rentals anymore because they need to have a certain level of owner occupancy.
Mm-hmm.
In order to qualify, so everybody can qualify for Fannie Freddie FHA financing.
I see.
So you need to ask the question as well. What is and get a, ask them to give you a current budget, current copy of the minutes of the last year or two,
mm-hmm.
and a copy of the rules and regulations and the condo declaration. And you should take some time and really look at these documents so that you understand. Like, a lot of times people buy into a condo and then they want to buy a big dog and they can't. I'm not saying you do, you're a medical student, but do you know what I mean? Or there may be restrictions on how many unmarried people or unrelated people can actually live in the same property.
I see. Those are all definitely things I can look into.
Yeah.
One other question I had about the HOA fees. Let's say that you want to know how stable the HOA fees are, like as a reflection of occupancy or whatever.
You would look at the budget for the last 2 years plus the projected budget, current and projected budgets.
Okay, and there's no way that they can hide that. Like, it would.
No, you'll see it, but also you're going to ask for the minutes, the building board minutes over the last 2 or 3 years, so that you can see what everybody's talking about every month in the building board meetings.
I see. Okay.
And you really need to take the time to do this because, you know, if your parents were that wealthy, you probably wouldn't have medical school bills and school loans, right?
Well,
so you have. Wait, hear me out.
Okay.
You can't say, you know, well, my parents are really wealthy and they're helping me, but then turn around and it turns into the situation blows up. Because once you buy into a condo, if there's a problem, a serious problem, and you need, let's say that they find, I'm gonna just completely make this up, but let's say they find that there is, I don't know, nuclear waste buried below your condo building.
Okay,
it's pretty unlikely, so I'm using that as the example.
Yeah.
But as an owner in that unit, if there needs to be a cleanup and the cleanup is $1 million, your share of that cleanup will be the percentage that your unit is of the property. So if that's 1%, you're going to owe 1% of $1 million to help clean up that problem. So you just really need to understand the risks. And today there are plenty of risks. So I'm not saying don't do it. I think at $50,000, the risk is really moderated. But I just want to make sure, because when you go on the line and your parents co-sign with you, you're putting them on the line as well. And if they do have assets, the building, the condo building, and the lender can tap into your parents' assets should something go seriously wrong here. So just make sure you really understand what you're doing, and that's why you look at the last 2 or 3 years of minutes. You're basically going to read what everybody talks about at the meetings. You're going to see the budgets for the last couple of years, whether they were under or over, what was, and then the current budget, what has been budgeted in for maintenance and upkeep going forward. And you're going to look at the building rules and regulations and the condo deck. And then you're going to really understand what you need to do and how you need to do it. And it just makes for being a much smarter buyer. So again, my books, which you can get on Amazon or at your local library, is called 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. And the other one is called Buy, Close, Move In. And it's all about what you need to know now after the housing crisis and how it's all going to work out. And so I just want you to take advantage. You sound like a smart guy. You're in medical school. Take advantage of the opportunity to really learn about what's going on here before you make this big move. 404-872-0750. News, weather, and traffic coming up at the top of the hour. Mark Tytel from GetOutStartOver.com is in the studio. He's going to be talking about short sales and for in-depth news coverage. Remember to pick up your Sunday Atlanta Journal-Constitution for a special report that examines how the 1-cent sales tax, the vote, could mean billions of dollars in transportation changes. It's 13 before the hour, AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey. And midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
Three minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show. Welcome back, everybody. We have Mark Tatel with us right now of GetOutStartOver.com. Mark is our foreclosure and short sale voice on the ground in Atlanta, sort of working at it day by day. So, Mark, earlier in the show, a guy named Brett called us, and he's driving around looking at houses, and he found a short sale, and it's the perfect house, the neighborhood's perfect, but he said the seller is not behind on his payments, and he owes far more than what it's listed for, and he thinks what it's listed for is far higher than what it should be, and he's wondering how this ever is going to work out, because the seller's agent is saying to the seller, well, we do this all the time when for doctors and lawyers who don't want to wreck their credit. But his agent is saying he never sees it work out successfully when you bid on a short sale that they haven't even talked to the bank about. And I'm just wondering from your, you know, your day-to-day experience, what do you see happening?
Well, first of all, let's take a big look at the big picture of what's happening on the market. When I started 17 years ago, foreclosure was a nightmare for us. To do the foreclosure meant that we have to go and jump all kind of hoops to buy the properties. Now we have a kind of new product, short sale, which is worse than foreclosure because there are so many unknowns. There are so many barriers to get to the finish line that a lot of selling agents, just like myself, were frustrated at points of, do we really want to do this? Do we really want to go through with this? And so I kind of understand the hesitation on the selling agent's part, but unless we learn how to do this right, unless we actually take in, we cannot really provide a good service to our client. So for this particular caller, I'd say this. If you really want to get a great deal, if you want to buy a short sale, you have to be patient, you have to start the game, and you have to follow the lead that the listing agent is showing you. Because listing agent will know exactly, step by step, what it requires to get you to the closing table.
That's if the short sale agent actually knows what he or she is doing. Now, one thing that they were trying to do is get this buyer to sign some sort of exclusivity arrangement where he wouldn't be looking at any other houses while they're going through this process. But that's, I told him that I didn't think that was a good thing to do.
I agree with you 100%. It's unreasonable. However, on the other end, you have to understand that in order for the bank to tell us exactly what price they will allow this property to be sold on the market, they have to have a written binding offer, not necessarily binding, but signed by all parties and accepted by the seller. Then you can go to the bank and say, all right, Mr. Bank, how much will you accept for this property so we can sell it right now, today, or within the 30-day period?
Now, how often these days, now you told us a couple of months ago that you thought that the length of time it's taking for banks to approve short sales has really gotten a whole lot faster, but how fast is it?
It is really, usually once you submit an offer within about 30 days or so, the bank will finalize on all documents. First of all, they will need that broker price opinion, independent agent that will go out, make pictures of the property, decide what the current fair market value is, and submit to the bank. Now, bank at that point usually goes through the committee and decides at what price they can let it go. And usually they use the formula. So it's probably going to be about 88-89% of the fair market value.
Okay. So we don't know. Let's just assume that the buyer's assessment of fair market value is a lot closer than what the seller's is. And they make their offer. Do you think that it has a, you know, at 88-89% of fair market value, you think that'll be right? You think it'll go through?
What I would do is, if I really want the property, I would just give a chance myself to get at the price that the seller is offering or at the price that the bank will allow you to have. Without playing the game, you will not know. So you have to be ready to go all the way to the end.
You know, it's interesting because I know that you do hundreds of foreclosures and short sales a year.
Correct.
And that's a significant amount. You know, what are some other things that you're telling sort of buyers and sellers about this? Because one of the things you always say is that with a short sale, banks do so much better than foreclosures because they don't have to spend, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 on legal maintenance, realtor fees. I mean, it seems like short sale is the best outcome that a lender and the ultimate investor is going to have.
Absolutely. It makes economic sense for the bank to go ahead and do the short sale versus to foreclose on the people. So what they are doing, if let's say the loan modification is not an option, short sale is the next best outcome for the bank. So we will cooperate and try to get your short sale approved, so long as it is reasonable, so long as it is the fair transaction where you're not selling to your brother, sister, mother, or cousin, you're not trying to deprive the money from the bank. I think bank will come out and help you out in this situation, because nobody in this market wants a foreclosure vacant home on a market, period.
Yeah, I know. It's really awful to have just yet another one. Mark Tatel, getoutstartover.com. If you've got questions about short sales or foreclosures, he is obviously the person who knows what the answer is. Mark, thanks so much for coming back on the show. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here. All right, folks, 58 minutes past the hour. Our time is up. The music is starting. Well, it will start. There you go. Music is starting. Clint's on the ball there today. If you have any questions for me, you know how to find me. ThinkGlink.com. ThinkGlink.com. I've been working on the show notes. I'm going to get those, catch up with those tweets that I'm a little bit behind on, and try and get these show notes up and out this afternoon. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy your day. I hope you have a great week. We've got Memorial Day next weekend. All kinds of great stuff coming up for you then. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. Andy Dean is next. Take care and stay tuned to News Talk WSB.